disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give up.
Greetings, friends, clients, colleagues, the occasional stray Republican who tunes in by accident. Don't you dare give up, and don't you dare give in. We listen to our, who is that? I always forget who's.
Blues Travelers.
Blues Traveler, one of my favorite bands, telling us that as sad and stressful as it is out there, we can't give up and we can't give in. There's too much work to do now. I'm joined here today in our Women's Rights in the Workplace show by my indefatigable colleague, Deborah Orell.
Hello, Jag.
How are you? And today we're very excited in our studio on the Upper West Side to have a prominent personal injury lawyer, Edward Steinberg, with us. And greetings, Edward. How are you?
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. We're just going to start out, though, today. You know, the news, some of the news that has sort of dominated, I guess, last week's news was the death of Joan Rivers, iconic comedian, writer. I believe she was a fashionista commentator, a sometime actress, and even
red
to
carpet.
Some, she, excuse me, the red carpet.
Carpet.
Well, wasn't she commenting?
She started the red carpet comments.
And she
that
was apparently
whole genre that there are now 20 million, you know, 20 shows all
I
about
see.
It.
And to some, even a feminist icon, right? Because, you know,
I
she
say.
Was, because although there are those who say a feminist, she was not, because she was at times a little bit cruel and mean and was not supportive necessarily of other women when she was vicious to them. She was someone who I think deep down was actually sort of an underdog.
She was groundbreaking.
Supporter. Well, she was groundbreaking.
And paved the way.
In a business heavily dominated by men.
Totally. Completely dominated by
so
men.
So we want to just play a clip, if you would here, Martin, to lead into our discussion with our guest, Joan Rivers clip, if you would now, Martin. Very short clip. Did you have that queued up, Martin, or should we?
People say to me, Joan, why do you hate? You're not that ugly. You're not that stupid. You're not that much of a failure in life. You had a friend once. So why do you hate, Joan? Why do you hate? And I'm going to tell you why. I hate not for me. No. I hate for you out there. The voiceless little people who have no outlet for their frustrations. And by voiceless little people, I do not mean mute dwarfs. I mean, they have a great outlet. They have the TLC network where they all have their own shows, usually at 9 o'clock between Hoarders and How Did I Get So Pregnant?
Thank you, Martin. So, Joan Rivers, standing up for the little people. And we have with us today an attorney, and we always talk about that, how what we do as attorneys is, I don't know, we would say little people. We stand up for the disempowered, those who are, as Elizabeth Warren would say, or perhaps getting, you know, on the short end of the stick in the rigged game, and those who can't afford access, and those who can't afford attorneys generally, and those who can't afford sort of, you know, equal justice under the law. And so
we help level the playing field.
Well, we try to help level the playing field, and so does is Eddie Steinberg, because Eddie represents people who have been grievously injured, and he is one of the top lawyers in New York State, renowned for his advocacy and his passion, his commitment to his clients. And in fact, Eddie was quoted just yesterday, the reason we played the Joan Rivers quote, he was quoted in the Daily News, the New York Daily News, as saying, and I quote, "Normally an 81-year-old widow with grown children," and he was referring to Joan Rivers, "is not expected to be working," said lawyer Edward Steinberg. "However, she was still a very big earner and in otherwise good health. There could be millions of dollars at stake." So I just want to just read you a little bit about Eddie's bio. I may call you Eddie?
Absolutely.
Okay. Edward Steinberg, founder, partner, and outstanding personal injury attorney. Oh, I'm sorry, that was me. Edward Steinberg has represented and assisted victims of significant personal injury and medical malpractice cases for the past 20 years. And he's all of 30 years old, so it's actually an amazing feat. At Levin Steinberg, the firm that he founded, and he's a partner, He has advocated for hundreds of clients and their families in their time of need, obtaining millions of dollars on their behalf. Countless successful results involved helping victims of negligence, even after other attorneys in New York rejected the cases. Edward Steinberg started out as a high school student at a prominent negligence firm in New York and continued to work at that firm while attending college and law school in the evenings. He held a position as a member and editor of the Law Review while in law school. And after being admitted to the bar and practicing for some time at that firm, Mr. Steinberg met Mr. Leave, his partner, and they formed what has grown to be one of the most aggressive, successful firms practicing negligence litigation in New York. One of Mr. Steinberg's noteworthy achievements involved a woman who was gravely injured, but the responsible party refused to compensate her for her injuries. The client ultimately recovered more money than was available in the defendant's insurance policy, making Mr. Steinberg one of the only attorneys in New York City to ever do so, to accomplish that feat. He is one of the youngest members to serve on the board of directors of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association, the New York State Bar Association, and the American Trial Lawyers Association. He has been counseled to the Brain Injury Society, a nonprofit organization which helps those who suffer from traumatic brain injuries. Mr. Steinberg has carried his work ethic and dedication to his personal life as well. He has run the New York City Marathon as well as several half marathons. And for the past 3 years, he has participated in a race across the entire state of New Jersey in a 92-mile race as part of a seven-person relay team. This year, the team finished 18th out of 135 teams, and Mr. Steinberg led his team with a sub-7-minute-per-mile pace.
Awesome.
Not too shabby.
Really?
And thank you so much.
You weren't driving during any of that time.
Definitely not driving during
no
most
cab.
Of it. Yes.
So Eddie Steinberg is the kind of top-shelf personal injury attorney I'd hire. I'd personally hire if I needed one. And guess what? I actually did.
I did twice.
Eddie represented me personally when I was in a motorcycle accident. And he represented my daughter, who was in a car accident when I crashed the car with her in it. And she had to sue me.
Yes, both true.
So, but I was very, very happy with Eddie's advocacy, and lawyers are not so easy to please. Eddie's explains everything until you want to get off the phone with him. Basically talks more than you want him to talk, which is always I try to model that as well. He cares about his clients deeply, and it shows. So
thank you so much for having me. Wow.
You're welcome.
Great intro. I appreciate that so much.
Well, you deserve it. I mean, really, there's not many. You know, listen, people, personal injury lawyers, right, get a bad rap. Right?
We get the worst of the rap.
The ambulance chasers, right, where they're chasing after the ambulance. You want to give. And so it's, you know, some people consider it the lowest form, like on the food chain. And you elevate, you know, the practice in a way that it's obvious that it's not about you. It's about your clients.
I tell clients all the time, and I think that's so true. You know, most of the legal profession very often is a non-contingency basis, and a client will come in and the lawyer will say, happy to help you, just give me $10,000 and I'll start working at $250 an hour or more,
$700 an hour,
and then I'll get back to you in a few months or a few weeks when all that money's used up. And they may not care about the ultimate outcome for the client, because two or three retainers in, they've got their money, and the client's outcome may just be pushed aside.
Right.
Everything that we do is completely in line with the client's interest. If we're going to be successful, it'll be that the client is successful. If we're going to take a risk, it's going to be a risk that we feel is worthwhile for the client and for us. And if at the outcome there is no recovery, then all of our time has been spent just processing and working on it, but without any cost to the client, which really does level the playing field. It gives so many people that I've represented access to a system that 95% probably could never afford. And that's made it really a very worthwhile experience. I happen to love what I do. And I think, by and large, we clearly are the checks and balances against, you know, good, bad business, if you will, or big, bad business, I should say. That's what we've been doing.
But and you do love what you do. Don't you?
Really, really, I do.
So when we're in a world now, I mean, you're talking to people who are sort of, you know, not your biggest cheerleaders for mega corporations. And when you're dealing with these banksters, you know, the insurance carriers that don't want to give, even where people have paid their premiums and at the time when the money is, you know, the rent's coming due because there's an injury, the first time the insurance companies are like, well, sorry, we're not paying now. Well, they're fighting you every step of the way, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's another thing that always, I think, makes the task so fulfilling, is that you have people that have committed wrongs. They've been negligent, whether it be a simple car accident or a property owner that leaves a crack on their sidewalk that expands and becomes dangerous. And then when their carrier should be fairly and adequately compensating the injured, the carrier, of course, having their own side interest and counsel, will decide to process that case along and defend it to the death, if you will, for 4 or 5 years. Interestingly, the lawyers that they're hiring are billing by the hour.
Right.
So the interest, again, becomes the lawyer dragging something on that could have been adequately resolved years and years earlier. So it always becomes that challenge to make sure that the carrier doesn't get away with saying to a defendant or to us, you know, we're not going to have to pay on that, or we're going to avoid paying on that. Our goal is to bring justice to those that have been, you know, done wrong to.
So I want to talk about a little bit. I want to break this down for our listeners so they really understand what you do and what to expect from a personal injury lawyer in the event that they're ever injured. We want to define what it is, or perhaps they are, I don't know, is the word, victim, or they've been hurt in a by a physician in a malpractice, for medical malpractice or dental malpractice, so forth, or they're in, again, an accident. But I just want to talk a couple of things. First of all, what can you explain your comment to the Daily News about the Joan Rivers case? That here was a let me just sort of set this up, because my own mom said to me the other day on the phone, who lives in Florida, that's something. What do you think about Joan Rivers? Ha, that's like something, huh? And I said, what's something? I said, I actually meant this at the time when I said, not knowing that much about it, I said, she was 81. It's like that George Carlin bit. It's like, you know, can you believe Cy died? He was 88. No, I could believe it. We don't accept death. She was 81. She died. Well, but she was healthy, right? She didn't die of natural causes in that endoscopy clinic, right?
Absolutely. As, you know, one would expect, she was cleared by a doctor to have the procedure. She was healthy enough to undergo the procedure. And then ultimately, she ended up going into cardiac arrest during the procedure. What happened to her during the procedure or after the cardiac arrest are the issues that the medical examiner is going to look at.
So, first of all, just, we have very bright listeners. These are not any Rush Limbaugh or Fox News automatons. They tend to be bright, but people don't know about any of these terms. Like, for instance, you've used the word a couple of times, carrier. You mean the insurance company when you use the word carrier?
Yes. Okay. I mean an insurance company.
Okay. So the average person is listening, their 81-year-old grandmother generally is, let's say, dies, unfortunately, in a procedure in the hospital. And the family believes that it was the result of a mistake, perhaps the anesthesiologist made, because she went in healthy for something that should have been minor. Why is that case, if it's not worth millions like Jones' case might be? Can you explain the differential?
Absolutely. Under New York law, and New York law was written maybe 80, 90 years ago specifically on this topic, the right of the estate for someone to bring an action for someone who dies, very simply, is limited to only two types of recovery. It's sad because New York is only one of 5 states that have this restriction. The main component that is not recoverable is the emotional loss that one suffers when they lose a next of kin, a brother, a sister, a parent. So the only two items that are recoverable, the only two things you can collect money for in New York, is your conscious pain and suffering, which is simply the period of time after the mistake in which someone is conscious, meaning aware, and suffering from that injury. And then the pecuniary loss, or the financial loss, that person dying has left on someone else. So sadly, the 81-year-old who's not supporting anyone, whose children are grown and independent of that parent, who, say, lives alone on Social Security, if they should die during a procedure where they were conscious for seconds at best, if at all, maybe they were under anesthesia when it happened.
Like Joan Rivers.
Correct.
Right.
Who probably had no consciousness suffering from this event, meaning during the endoscopy, presuming she had general anesthesia. It could have been local, and she might have felt something during the cardiac arrest if it was local anesthesia, but I believe for the endoscopy it was general. Then she would have no conscious pain and suffering, because she immediately went from cardiac arrest to a state of unconsciousness. In fact, I think the family put her into a medically induced coma,
right,
to sedate her body and keep her calm. You'd only have the financial loss. And amazingly, most 81-year-olds, probably 99%, have never or are not earning at that stage of their life money that others are relying upon or money that would go to their estate. Joan here, on the other hand, probably was making millions of dollars a year, and that loss for her based on life expectancy, which could be another, at 81, the governmental charts probably would give her a life expectancy, assuming good health, probably close to 90 or 92. She could have earned the millions of dollars a year for the next 7 or 8 or 9 years. And that would be a money that would be able to be what's considered a pecuniary loss to her estate.
To her estate, not even to a particular person.
Correct. If it turns out that she was giving her daughter money every month or on some repeated basis, or she employed her daughter that no longer has that position, absolutely recoverable directly.
So let me understand this. If I'm an elderly gentleman and I'm married to an 81-year-old who, and both of us are retired and average folk, and the same thing happens to her, but we're retired, and I just lost, let's say, the woman I was married to for 60 years because of somebody's negligence or malpractice. They killed her, right? She, let's say, like Ms. Rivers, was not conscious, and she has no pecuniary loss because she hasn't earned a dime in 20 years, my wife, let's say. So my distress over losing my wife because of some asshole's incompetence or negligence is not compensable in New York.
Not compensable in New York
now,
at all.
That is, and what are the, who are the, which are the other four states?
You know, I believe it's among the smaller ones. I think it's Iowa. It might be Minnesota. It might be Oregon. And I can't think of the fourth.
Because they're not even red states.
No, absolutely not. It's among the smallest of minorities, if you will, that this rule has not been updated to accept that those that lose someone, it's not only about the financial or the conscious pain and suffering, but again, the carrier or the insurance company lobby in New York has fought very hard to say we can't open the door and allow the emotional loss to just come into play because the awards would just be these runaway awards.
But in the
other
45 states, including, I guess, some places perhaps like Alabama or Mississippi, I don't know if it's included, where you can, this elderly 82-year-old man who's lost his wife because of somebody's wrongdoing can get something from
even
my
in
pain,
New Jersey,
from my pain?
Just across the river in New Jersey, you
and
can do that.
And Connecticut, then.
Yes.
California. It's a huge state, too.
What? That you can?
Yeah.
You can recover, absolutely.
Okay, but that also is going to be sometimes the lion's share, no, of a recovery if there's very little pain and suffering?
It would be. But again, the one aspect of the law is it's not just the jury's decision. There's an appellate process. And ultimately, if a jury was to give a figure that would be far removed from what the courts would consider to be fair and reasonable, the courts would review it, just like they've reviewed conscious pain and suffering verdicts. There is, sadly, a line of cases that one can look at and say, what is someone who's conscious for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 seconds, or 10 seconds worth,
well,
and it's within that range.
New York, there's just the ranges so people have an idea of what seconds to minutes mean.
Sadly, there's an award out there. I was just taking a look at of a family who was awarded, I think, $1.5 million for an elderly person who was killed by a jury, probably had, according to the article. Was killed by a vehicle in an accident. A jury awarded $1.5 million, and the appellate division and the Court of Appeals reduced that award to $100,000, saying that that person's conscious pain and suffering was limited to maybe seconds, and the pecuniary loss might have been limited to some slight guidance that the parent was giving a grandchild, both financial and non-financial, so that there is some component to, I would give them money every month on their birthday, or they lived in my household, so I would be the one that bought the dinner every Sunday, that kind of recovery. But a $1.5 million award was reduced by the appellate division and the Court of Appeals to $100,000.
Is that because, sort of almost a jury nullification thing, the jury heard it and said, we're going to give this amount, and then the courts try to keep a certain amount of consistency with... Is that, or is it?
That's
sort
exactly
of
what it is.
Oh,
that's
is.
Exactly what's happening.
So, did it make sense from your perspective? Was it seems like was that a miscarriage of justice, or was that appropriate given the line of New York cases?
I think that was on the lower end. I mean, sometimes one would hope to see that the courts might, with someone who has grandchildren who are living in the household, maybe there is some proof there of financial support to the grandchildren, allow an award to stand that would be double or triple what they ultimately allowed. So, 100 was really, really, you know, cutting away the jury's award tremendously.
Let me just ask you, while we're still on Joan Rivers, about conscious pain and suffering. This is probably moronic and sort of what maybe a sort of a lay person's, I guess, thinking on this, because I was reflecting on, I was thinking that it could be worse for someone like Joan Rivers who doesn't know, on some level, she never got a chance. If she were conscious for a day or two or three, even with some pain, to process that she might not be well, to say her goodbyes, to come to terms with, maybe to have an awakening, what this life is worth, it, as opposed to thinking she's still like, okay, I got to be somewhere. She doesn't know she died. You know what I mean? There's something
sure
about that. And yet we still will apportion, maybe you could talk about your Crane case, the idea that if you're if you're awake, somehow conscious, however they did, for 5 minutes before you die, that might make, you know, we're sort of counting the seconds and going, ooh, that was painful. We have to give you $100,000 per half a minute of pain.
Sure. It's such a backwards thinking way that our system has been created. But again, it's the law that was written 100 years ago to try to create some balance, because it used to be, without that law, that there was no recovery if you died. And people started to say, wait a second, someone's dying. We have to create a system that at least allows for some recovery. So, for example, as you were mentioning, I do represent the estate of the family of one of the deceased, a woman who died. It was a 29-year-old woman back in 2008, right here on East 51st Street, in the crane collapse,
well,
a terrible crane accident.
Give the backstory on this terrible crane
accident. We were at the height of the real estate market in, I think it was March 2008. Properties were being converted from small commercial establishments to 20, 30-story residential co-ops. So it was, you know, it was a theme of build them as quick as you can. A particular property on East 51st Street went up. They had hired...
And these are multi, you know, billion dollar. These are not, we're putting up row houses or...
Sure, this was
right?
going to be, I think, a 30-story building, probably several hundred units. And the owner of the property had decided...
Million-dollar condos. All
multi-million dollar condos. Yeah, the owner of the property decided to hire a worldwide general contractor company based out of Canada. And they came on site. They were going to be the general contractor. And while the process was going on, sometimes and often the cranes, these huge things that we see sitting in the city skyline, are bolted into the ground, into the earth structure, because they're pushed very high up. And oftentimes the wind and other things can cause them to become very to lose their balance. Here, in a rush to get it built quickly, Con Edison, that has to come to these buildings and put their utility below that ground, the builder and the general contractor wanted first to have the Con Ed utility in place rather than waiting for the building to be built and then have Con Ed come out and ruin the front of the property for the utility installation. So Con Ed came, put the utility installation in. Now the crane company had to make a decision. Are we going to put the crane on top of the Con Ed structure but not into the earth structure, and see if it'll if it would be stable? Ultimately, that crane was being jumped, I think, from the, I forget which particular floor, but it was certainly midway up the building when the crane and its ropes and pulleys snapped, causing the crane to flip over the entire block. So my client was living on East 50th Street, and the crane snapped over that block and came into a townhouse that she was a guest of and had come in for the weekend of the holiday, and she was in her apartment with a friend, and all of a sudden they heard this crashing noise coming from the roof. She was on the second floor, and the crane crushed through the roof. It crushed through the fourth floor, the third floor, ultimately came into her apartment and crushed her, along with her roommate, who happened to live through the events.
Well, so she has a better case, the roommate?
There you go, back to the conscious pain and suffering. The roommate, a gentleman who's lived with broken legs but is now back to living and walking and being, has possibly a more financially stronger case than my case of a woman who was
died.
29 years old, an only child of Cuban parents whose parents were living in Cuba. She was from Miami, was a hardworking woman here in the States, had come to this country, was selling products that she would buy in the New York area down at markets in Hialeah. And other than the possible 4 to 7 minutes that our expert has determined, pathologist is shown in conscious pain and suffering, we also have several hundreds of dollars a month that she would wire by Western Union to her parents. But her recovery at that interpretation of New York law is limited to those two components. So the emotional loss by a mother who's lost her only daughter, the emotional loss by a father who will never see his daughter get married or speak to his daughter ever again, or know that they'll never have children or have grandchildren again, is not recoverable.
Unbelievable. So what is recoverable? 29 years old. So what's recoverable?
Maybe the 5 to 7 minutes that our pathologist has said she was conscious. Now, conscious includes pre-impact terror. So before you're injured, you're hearing the crash, and it's the type that you know is not going to be good. So sometimes when you have those accidents where someone is, say, stopped, and they look in their rearview mirror and they see a tractor trailer coming, and through expert evidence you can show that that's going to last 3 to 5 seconds.
Of the barreling into you?
And you know that that's not going to be a good impact, yeah, obviously. Okay. That's considered pre-impact terror, part of the conscious pain and suffering. Because someone's feeling that, oh, my God, something's about to happen to me that I may very well die from.
And then after the tractor-trailer hits and I'm alive for whatever period of time, is that a different kind of terror or pain and suffering?
That's just post-impact conscious pain and suffering.
Okay.
And that's what her limitation would be. Our pathologist has determined from the autopsy, tissue samples, testimony of the person in her apartment with her, the way the screams were going on, that she was conscious based upon all of those things for between 5 and 7 minutes.
So, first of all, does the insurance company have their own pathologist?
As of right now, they have not hired a pathologist. I anticipate this case, as you can tell, now languished for 6.5 years.
And they still haven't hired a pathologist, but they will?
I would anticipate that they would. Now, there were 7 other laborers who died, and those cases were settled under the labor law of New York.
Okay.
My case is still ongoing because I have to prove negligence along with other personal injury victims that were injured and other property damage victims who suffered property damage, the loss of business, the loss of their townhouse, the loss of other businesses going on there.
So you mean the fact that, and you mentioned it, I don't know by any stretch whether this is correct or not, but if it wasn't bolted to the ground, into the ground, because someone made a decision that it might be more feasible, more expeditious to put it on top of the Con Ed structure, it seemed like an economic or a speed issue, right? It was a corner-cutting issue, perhaps?
It was get it up as quick as we can issue, along with, I think, a lack of oversight on the type of equipment they were using for the type of project they were doing in the location that they had chosen. It was too large of a crane on too unsupported a structure.
Well, why'd the cable snap? That seems to be different than stability.
Well, there's been studies by our expert engineers that all of the plaintiffs still pending have hired that show that the cables and the wear and tear, this is a crane that wasn't being used for the first time. This crane was being used at other projects on previous occasions, gets rigged down and then rigged up, and now you're just transporting these belts and hoists in the same form and fashion, and they're getting worn. And the checking of those and the monitoring, the wear and tear, along with the wind, how high you're going, and what structure it's in on the ground, all together, it's our opinion, was the reason that the crane was unsupported in that environment and snapped.
Not per se negligence, though. This is still an issue for a jury.
Well, it sounds like it was. They
made
bad
decisions. We think it's pretty
clear-cut
that the owners and the general contractors ignored and should have been aware, certainly if they weren't aware, that what was going to happen was a very likely outcome of this lack of care.
So a 29-year-old...
They weren't erring on the side of caution, of being protective.
Right. Clearly.
And so what happened is exactly the worst nightmare. That's a...
So a 29-year-old woman is dead, and because she seems to have had, this is a little bit itinerant, she was perhaps going down to Hialeah to flea markets and selling things and making an unsteady income, let's say, and probably not, if you look at her W-2s or whatever, she wasn't earning great amounts of money, right?
Correct, and the courts have always said, you know, we just have to err towards conservative. If you can't prove it with some certainty, we're not going to allow a no or low wage earner to say
29.
I'm 29, and you know by the time they get to 35 or 37, as the majority of us will find stability, find a career path, start a family, just not allowed under New York law.
So just right now, just to cap this, this woman who, in it, you know, was obviously didn't contribute in any way to her demise, right? Nothing.
Absolutely.
So completely innocent, and there were a number of entities that were raking in lots of money from this project.
Without a doubt.
What would you say that her several minutes of pain might yield, just so people have
We are arguing and have made demands into the 7 figures for the family, both on conscious pain and suffering and on the pecuniary loss put together. I will say with some certainty, based upon the appellate division cases of something similar, we probably are looking at an award, even if given by the jury in excess of that, that would be reduced to somewhere close to the mid to higher range of 6 figures, not touching 7 figures.
Really?
Sadly.
For a death.
For the death of someone.
And the roommate who just broke his legs, he might actually get more money from that?
Absolutely, because he can argue, I might need future surgeries, the medical care comes to that, he might argue.
But he's fine now.
That's the battle. That's why, sadly, in our state, living through a tragedy and suffering is worth a lot more than not living through it and being a terrible loss to your family, to loved ones, that component of that emotional loss does not exist in New York. Sadly, the minority in our country, I'm hopefully one day with efforts of cases like this coming to light and others, the courts will, you know, consider changing and the legislature will follow suit.
And what about with a child who dies as a result of negligence, who doesn't have a paycheck yet?
Exactly the same. Exactly the same.
What's the pecuniary loss?
None. That child, it would be an absolute zero. You could have a teenager who might have started to work, who still lives at home, and parents would say he gave us $50 a week. So you can extrapolate
out. So your kid, let's say a kid of, just to separate this to make it obvious, not to distinguish between levels of income and children, but a child of a professional family who would clearly perhaps be on his or her way to earning money. He's not like the 29-year-old client who's working, let's say, in a flea market. No one speculates. They're not allowed to. So because it's a child, the 9-year-old who doesn't have a job, zero for the next 80 years of what this kid might have done, even if he was a prodigy who showed a propensity for science and math and wanted to be an astrophysicist at 9, zero?
Zero.
Unless his value is?
On the pecuniary component, a zero. It's almost hard to discuss. If there was conscious pain and suffering, of course there's a value to that. But you wouldn't want, as both a parent of that child or even as their lawyer, you wouldn't want them to have suffering. So a child crossing the street, hit by a car that doesn't see the car coming, so there's no pre-impact terror.
Unbelievable.
Struck by the car from behind, he strikes his head and ultimately is rendered, you know,
unconscious.
And they check at the autopsy, the brainstem is separated from the spinal cord. There could be a recovery of $50,000.
What about the parents watched him get hit by that car?
If the parents are in the zone of danger, not just seeing it, but close enough that they too could have been injured, then a claim for psychological and emotional injuries of their own can exist. Again, that claim has been found by the appellate division to have very, very limited values.
So wait a minute. So if both parents are standing safely on the sidewalk, but 5 feet from the zone of danger, and they watch the car coming, and the car smashes their kid through the windshield, and they're barely now able to function, these parents, for years, there's no value to that claim. Still,
no, because they're not really in the zone of danger. If they were crossing with the child, it's different. But just watching the child run across the street or run towards them now.
This is like the phone calls we take every day when people call in, I was wrongfully terminated, and we have to tell them the sad, sorry state of employment in the United States, that, yes, your employer is allowed to
be an asshole.
Exactly. So I have to imagine this is what you have to say all day long.
All day long.
Like, people don't—because I'm with my jaw dropped. I can't believe this.
So the person that even we were talking a little earlier about, a client who believed that her kindergartner was perhaps sodomized, perhaps, or otherwise sexually abused at school, also a claim like that, putting aside liability for the moment, that doesn't have much value either, potentially, for different reasons?
That would have value if you can prove that the events occurred and there was liability for the psychological injuries that child will continue to go through. So documenting the child's psychological damages from the event could be extraordinary.
Why couldn't you do that in that case? Because you mentioned that it was more of a modest resolution.
Well, that child, from all intensive reviews by both psychologists, by the time that child reached, I think it was third or fourth grade, was doing well in classes, was interacting well socially. I have had, sadly, the case of a young child who was raped in a New York City Housing Authority project. Our claim of negligence was that the Housing Authority had inadequate security that allowed that perpetrator to gain access to the building and then commit the terrible crime. And that case did result in a very, very substantial award because that child was not doing well. That child had not been able to integrate back into regular school. He had exhibited signs of becoming very, very closed in and very, very quiet. And the doctors and psychiatrists were noticing that this was going to be someone who was sexually assaulted and was clearly suffering from the post-traumatic stress of that event. That was and is a very, very significant case. Again, both going back to, can you, with a reasonable amount of certainty, document real damages, that emotional, we just feel bad, though I think there's a level that we can find a balance and allow such a recovery. The New York courts have said, you know, we're just not going to go there. We're not going to say someone could have been a good wage earner. We're not going to say a family really feels bad because maybe they weren't even on good terms with him. It really is very, very unfortunate.
Really. And when you use the word damages as lawyers, do you mean the harms and or the losses that the plaintiff sustained?
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, economic damages, which are the financial losses. So if you can't go to work for a certain period of time after someone's negligent conduct, that's, you know, money that you're entitled to recover. Then there's non-economic damages, which is the pain and suffering, which is in all respects the most significant part of what people suffer from. I've represented people who've been permanently disabled, and though they may have been able to make it back to work either in a different capacity, the pain that they suffer from each and every day,
physical or emotional or both?
Both, is never going away. So I think our society sometimes wants to look at the black and white. Where's the economic? You went back to work, you're making a salary, you're okay. But that takes out of the equation the person who wants to...
Quality,
and get on their knees with their grandchild. I had a client several years ago that was caught between a train and the platform, and her leg was crushed, and she was in her late 60s, was about to retire. There was no wage component to the case at all. And at trial, my partner tried the case. She testified, you know, I worked my whole life. I saved. I have two grandchildren. She was of African-American descent. All I wanted when I got older was to spend quality time with my grandchildren, to teach them about our culture, to take them, you know, to museums, to be an active grandparent. And I've lost that. I've lost that entirely. And it was really on that the jury gave a very significant award, because the pain and suffering includes an emotional loss. So you can describe your loss of enjoyment of life.
Okay.
And that was a woman who, it wasn't a wage component, but a very real component, something that all of us, if we're sitting here working, we're hoping one day to be that grandparent, God willing, or be that
right
older person that's independent and active. And if someone takes that away from you, knocks you off that path that you were supposed to be on, compensation is the only way we can, you know, give it back. And there is a checks and balance against runaway juries. I always find it remarkable when people say, oh, the jury just awards anything. It's not the case at all. If the jury gives too large of an award, there's an appellate review process.
So was that award sustained?
Yes, that award was sustained on the damages aspect. There was ultimately an appeal on the liability aspect. There were certain things about the engineering, and the result ended up being a confidential settlement.
So, first of all, you representing Joan Rivers?
I am not representing Joan Rivers. I was consulted by the Daily News, just given a background and expertise in medical malpractice. At the moment, I am not representing the estate.
At the moment, okay. Well, there's always time, and
yes,
that might change.
You might get that call from Melissa.
That's right.
Hey, I have a question.
Sure, please.
You know, going back to what you were talking about, the child who was potentially molested. So, because rape on, you know, campuses, rapes that happen in public housing, because there isn't security, would women have a claim?
I think both women and
men... I mean,
men,
I'm speaking, I know that there's, you know...
Sure, I think any...
In general, but...
School organization has an obligation to provide reasonable, safe care or premises for its students, teachers, or others. And at any time, if someone is injured or, God forbid, sexually abused on campus, and that complaint gets filed and properly looked into, and let's say it's determined that the reason that was able to occur was because in this particular part of the campus, our lights and our timers of our lights seem to go off too early. So that becomes a very dark corner of the campus, and this is a problem. So they mark that in a file. They maybe give it off to their department. Let's try to work on that. That, of course, gets put to the bottom of the barrel. Nothing happens. 6 months later, the next semester, another person is assaulted precisely in the same area. Well, now the school is on notice that
right,
something could occur, and that would absolutely open a school to liability and responsibility, because they should have known and knew. that an area was becoming more dangerous. They failed to take adequate steps to render reasonable care. It's always a question of reasonableness.
Right.
And I think many times defendants want to say that we could never have predicted this was going to happen. But, you know, when you do your homework, completely aside, though, I'm not sure on topic, I represented a woman, very sweet woman, who fell outside the fancy Apple store, the GM building. And she fell due to, there used to be a moat that was around the property. And when she fell because of that moat was undetectable when one would exit the store in the darkness. So you'd come out of the store, if you made a right or a left, you were in the moat, unless you walked 3 feet straight. Without going into all the details, because again, the settlement was confidential, my client fell, had a very bad arm injury, and it seemed such an odd layout. And ultimately, when we went through discovery and all of the evidence about how they built that Apple store and what Steve Jobs' particular desires were and what Mr. McAlow, who owned the building at the time, was, they wanted, from a visual perspective, to have that moat there, no color change, no warning. And turned out several people before my client had the exact same injury, and no one decided to change it. The evidence that we obtained of the priors allowed our case to get resolved. Mm-hmm. And happily, and I do think part of what I'm proud of, within about 15 months of me filing my lawsuit, that moat was entirely filled in. So if one visits the Apple store now, you can exit the store, make a left or a right. You
on
will not fall over anymore.
5th and 59th or 7th? Like that?
At the GM building, which I think is 58th Street and right off 5th Avenue.
Yeah.
Correct. So, again, it's part of being on notice of a problem and
right.
choosing to do nothing about it okay. is what we're always right. trying to fight for.
So, I think to Deborah's question, in our world where, let's say, one out of four college-age women are sexually assaulted, the latest statistics on the failure of our American, you know, colleges and universities to protect our young women, unless if it's just sort of a cultural issue that doesn't involve a broken lock or bad lighting or something, again, it's the colleges are not doing something, they're failing.
Well, they're not investigating, they're not protecting the women after they report it.
After the fact that they're not mostly. In other words, if we called Ed and said, or if someone calls Ed and says, I was, if this became sort of suddenly you were getting calls from women who were clearly sexually assaulted or raped on their college campuses through, let's say, no fault of their own, but there is an inordinate number of sexual assaults in this college, but you can't sort of put your finger on why it's happening from what the college is doing, although they often poo-poo it and don't get law enforcement involved and want to keep it on the DL because...
Or hire security or do the things
right.
they're supposed to do. But I was also thinking about the, you know, public housing because
right.
there's so much crime that goes on there.
And I think our present mayor has actually indicated just a few months
yeah.
ago that they're going to try to put more cameras in.
Yeah.
It becomes
okay.
part of your
right.
obligation. So
right.
though I think a school or university can keep trying to bury the experience that's or the terrible acts that are going on, ultimately through discovery and God willing judges that understand the need for expansive discovery rather than restrictive discovery, one can gather that there were 15 assaults after college games, let's say, that always seem to occur, you know, just in the parking lot of that stadium. Well, maybe the school needs to do more.
Right.
How about even the woman right now, and I may not be exact on the facts, but the woman, the Columbia law student
who's carrying
the mattress and
class to class.
The guy has assaulted other women. So wouldn't the college be responsible that they did not expel him, arrest him, put him in jail, do something with him?
I would certainly think they should.
Yeah,
I agree. It's like keeping an employee on your payroll that has prior bad acts. You have negligent
right.
hiring, negligent retention.
Right. There you
right.
go.
You know, you can't
right.
turn a blind eye and say, I didn't know that my worker or my students did this.
Right.
You can't do that. That's
right.
not what our society was, you know, supposed to
right.
be.
Wow.
So you've mentioned checks and balances a couple of times, and people think, you know, if you talk to our Chamber of Commerce or our businesses who pretty much own many of our senators and our Congress folk, particularly of a certain persuasion, who were always talking about so-called tort reform and the trial lawyers, and you guys are always the woman who guy burned her vagina with a cup of coffee, got $75 million, or the burglar who fell through the roof and cut his leg on your table, and he got 50. It's out of control, and these personal injury lawyers are just, you know, basically just, you know, vultures, and they're all they want to do is make tons of money and make mountains out of molehills. What do you say to the people who always bring up the McDonald's case? Did it exist? What happens? What are they saying? What's wrong with that picture?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Jack, because the truth is there's a wonderful documentary, I believe, on HBO called Hot Coffee. I'd recommend it to all of the listeners, both you as well and Deborah.
On demand? You could get it now?
I'm sure it's still. It was a prior documentary issued by HBO maybe 18 or 24 months ago.
Yeah.
To start with, obviously, it's called Hot Coffee. It starts with the McDonald's.
And it wasn't about, yeah.
It starts with the McDonald's case. So, first of all, when McDonald's was sued by that woman who was injured, they immediately put this PR spin on the verdict. And people
there was
got,
a verdict, though.
Well, there was a verdict, which ultimately was reduced tremendously, again, by a higher court.
It's not like she got that money that
correct.
People were saying. Okay.
But amazingly enough, what was never discussed, and the Hot Coffee documentary does a great job at it, was that, A, she was a passenger. So her and her nephew, I believe it was, had gone to McDonald's drive-thru, had asked for two coffees. She wasn't putting it between her legs and driving. They pulled right from the drive-thru into a parking space in the McDonald's lot. He handed her the coffee. As she was trying to take the top off to put whatever, I think, condiments or others in, it spilled on her, in her legs, causing horrific.
It really was horrific.
They showed the pictures.
With grafting needed to her private parts, right through her clothing. So the family did some investigation, and I may be wrong on some of the numbers, but I can say with certainty McDonald's had been warned by the Food Administration of our country that through random testing at all of the McDonald's franchises around our country, this is before the incident, you're serving coffee at, I think it was 15 or 20 degrees too hot. McDonald's then sent a letter memo to every franchise owner. We're aware of the warning. We don't care. We want the hottest coffee on the street. So we'll continue to serve the coffee. And I believe there were possibly, I don't know if it was 200 or 300 burns in like the 3 years prior.
So that 20 to 30 degrees is obviously significant. To me, it doesn't sound like
much.
Sure,
well, the moment you cross over 120 degrees.
What's the difference between it being 60 outside and 80?
Well, that still wouldn't seem to me to be. Yeah. It's like the difference between maybe 80 and 105 then or something, right? I mean.
Oh, if it becomes extraordinary.
It's boiling.
It was on contact.
Okay.
So McDonald's was aware. And they were warned, and they chose to ignore the warning. Then she went to trial. She was awarded, I think it was like $2.5 million. And the ultimate reduction was, I think, down to like $200,000 or $300,000. And again, the documentary discusses both that case, showing again, there wasn't a runaway verdict. She wasn't a woman driving her car at 30 who said, let me just leave this nice, closed cup of coffee between my legs. She was doing everything that everyone who buys coffee would do. Presumably they were in a car. She was a passenger. So that's just one example. The other example was the...
And nobody would choose, nobody, even all the Republicans that say it's an outrage, would choose to burn their genitalia and get skin grafting on their private parts for a couple $100,000.
Of course not. And the next segment of that documentary says in several states we have caps on medical malpractice awards, meaning in certain states... They've decided, New York at the moment is not one, that if you obtain an award for pain and suffering over $1 million, it will be reduced to $250,000. It's a random number that someone came up with, and I think there might be 18 or 20 states that have implemented it. And they go through in the documentary an example of a family who had a brain-damaged baby who was left with cerebral palsy, whose parents said, look, the child's going to live, and we're not going to be around to take care of that child forever. And that multi-million-dollar verdict was reduced to $250,000. And I believe in that same state or in a different state where the cap exists, one of the U.S. senators from that state who had agreed to the law, one of his children was the victim of malpractice for his wife and said years later, I did not know what I was signing on to. I didn't realize that you're just taking away someone's ability to be able to take care of themselves.
To correct a wrong.
It's part of our massive income inequality in this country, where 98% of all the new money in the last 20 years has gone to the top 0.1%. So,
sure.
I mean, because again, then we're expecting in how many states? Did you say about 18 states?
I think 18 states have caps on damages for medical malpractice.
But they're insignificant. $250,000, that includes the third that goes to the attorney?
Of course.
So then if you're left with $150,000 for a grievous lifelong injury, it's meaning, I mean, it'll last a year.
You end up going on public assistance. You end up becoming, and you wouldn't have to have been. That's what this family, I think, in the brain damaged baby case said. We don't believe it, but this jury wanted to give us recourse so that our child, we would know forever, would be taken care of. And now we're applying for Medicaid and public assistance and all the other benefits that the government is going to have to cover forever.
All right, let me ask you this, because we're, you know, this is valuable. I just want to go through a couple of things. Wikipedia's definition of personal injury is a legal term for an injury to the body, mind, or emotions, as opposed to an injury to property. Is that accurate?
Yes. Okay. Personal injury would be exactly that definition.
Okay. In Anglo-American jurisdictions, the term is most commonly used to refer to a type of tort lawsuit. What's a tort?
A tort is a wrong committed by another. So we have intentional torts. That's your assault, your battery, your criminal acts. Those are intentional torts. And then you have non-intentional torts, which is the negligence.
Okay.
Things like you negligently drove your car without paying attention to the traffic signs. You negligently maintained your home, allowing a recurring leak to leak and cause your ceiling to collapse and injure someone. Those are unintentional or negligent torts.
So it refers to a type of tort lawsuit alleging that the plaintiff's injury has been caused by the negligence of another, but also arises in defamation torts. Damages include bodily injury, you've talked about intentional infliction of emotional distress, and negligent infliction of emotional distress. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that sums up the general conception of what personal injury is and what a tort is.
So just so people who are listening to you will know what to call you and your firm about in terms of the work that you do when we talk about this so generally, I just want to read things that you cut. Maybe you could explain this briefly. You indicate that your firm handles premises liability. Let me just go through these. Premises liability, medical malpractice, negligence of organizations, transportation accidents, construction accidents, general negligence, products liability, and wrongful death. Those are separate types of claims within the world of personal injury, within the civil, under these civil wrongs, the different kinds of civil wrongs, no?
Yes, I would say in the category of negligence law, or tort law, as some might say, one can represent someone for a negligent act at or on a premises.
So tell us about this before we run out of time, because at least in our some of our listeners are often sort of attuned to workplace issues. Tell us about what happens in New York if you're injured on the job. Can you sue your employer? Can they call you if it's a workplace injury?
We represent many people injured on the job. The New York State Workers' Compensation Law, I believe it's Section 29, says specifically one cannot sue their employer for negligence.
Is that in every state?
I think it's across the board. I would say pretty confidently that at least 45 of the 50 states.
So I'm working for, you know, Ajax Cleaning Company. The ceiling falls on my head through no fault of my own one night when I'm cleaning the floor. Thank you. And I'm seriously injured, and probably my career will never be the same. I'm a manual laborer. I'm seriously hurt. I can't sue Ajax?
Correct. You have the right, regardless of fault, regardless of any energy or effort that you would normally need to prove why that collapsed, what was wrong with it, you have a right to simply go and file a workers' compensation claim without proving fault, just that I was on the job, I am an employee, and I was injured. And automatically you're entitled to receive wages and medical benefits.
Not your full wages,
probably. No, wages usually start off at sometimes 2/3 of salary. And then, of course, there's the compensation
too, right?
Who that will cap you. The board, the workers' compensation board, will try to say you are able to go back, so they'll try to cut you back. And then, ultimately, your medical could even be cut off when the board or their doctors say, I think you've reached a point where you don't need any more treatment or therapy. So your recovery is very limited.
So where do you come in?
You take that same scenario, you're in the Ajax factory, you are working, Federal Express had just come to drop off 20 boxes. When they dropped off their 20 boxes, rather than leaving them in their assigned place, because the driver was in a rush, he opened up the door to the delivery area and he threw them. Two of them ended up kind of behind the doorway. you happened to be walking without being able to see behind that doorway quickly, and you tripped and fell over that FedEx box. Same rules apply. You're injured on the job while working for Ajax. You go and get workers' compensation. However, a third party, meaning not your employer, has committed the wrong that injured you. That's where you can come to my law firm or a negligence law firm and say, can I sue that third party that committed this act? And you can, in every state under New York law for sure.
In addition to the workers' comp.
Correct. And you could receive your workers' compensation benefits, your wages, your medical bills. You can bring a claim against the third party for pain and suffering, the difference between the wages that you would normally earn versus what they're giving you. And then ultimately, at the conclusion of the negligence case, in that same section of the workers' comp law, you're obligated to give back any money that they gave you. Minus what the attorney kind of worked to protect for the workers' compensation lien. So in theory, it's one-third is the standard. There's a lot of other formulas depending on certain scenarios. But just very simply, someone is injured on the job. They have been given $100,000 in benefits. They bring a third-party lawsuit and recover $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have to give back $66,000 of their net award to workers' compensation. So comp or workers' compensation is ultimately reimbursed.
Okay.
So bringing the third-party case, in fact, helps
right.
the workers' compensation world because it should lower the premiums that their employers are paying because their carrier is getting money back from virtue of the recovery of the third-party case.
But if you can't sue your Ajax factory and the FedEx, so the examples like that might be a little, maybe fewer and far further between, but what about the ceiling, people who put up the ceiling or the chandelier or something?
You'd have to show that there was negligence. So if the ceiling was up and good for the last 15 years and Ajax workers are maintaining it and Ajax engineers were the ones who were monitoring it and what turned out to be the reason it fell was a slight leak from the closest bathroom seeping into the ceiling, but Ajax had their own internal maintenance staff.
What about if Ajax was negligent and the flood came and they didn't do what they had to do to maintain the integrity of the ceiling?
You're limited to workers' compensation.
Wow.
Unless you can find a third party, and the theory in New York is called the Espinal theory because there's a case called Espinal that says if there's a third party, say Ajax, and they probably would, in a huge Ajax building, they're going to go hire maybe their own a separate maintenance company. So Ajax is not going to have the manpower that's doing the maintenance work.
Suppose you're in the building, you're just renting space. You work in an office, and you get hurt at the job because the ceiling falls. It would be the building.
Correct.
Who would be your third party?
Right. The building, maybe the managing agent of the building, mm-hmm. the property manager. Again, if you're working in a big office building, can't sue your employer. If you're in suite 303 working for ABC Corp, can't sue them. But you might find out that the building was negligent, and you can absolutely sue the building.
So we have less than 60 seconds. Let me ask you this. First of all, is it just New York, or will you handle cases in New Jersey or Connecticut?
I have relationships with lawyers in New Jersey, in many other states, in Florida, in California, in Delaware, in Pennsylvania. So we can work together, and I have worked with other lawyers on other states.
So people who may be listening and like what they hear and how you present can call you, even if they're in Pennsylvania, you might find someone.
No matter where they are, they should call him.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He is the lawyer for everything.
And the types of cases, so people know the so-called slips and falls, those are the types of cases you handle.
Sure.
Wrongful death, products liability, if someone's injured by a product they're using and it goes
Absolutely.
Awry and their hair lights on fire.
Sure.
Okay, and as we mentioned, what else?
You have your labor law accidents where you have construction workers injured on the job. You have your automobile accidents. You have municipal liability when schools are negligent when it comes to
right.
students not being properly supervised or being injured at a gym.
Phone number, where can they find you?
The office number is 212-766-5222. I've actually given out.
5222?
5222. My cell number, which is available by text and or call, is 917-612-5046.
And the website?
www.nyaccidentlawyer.com or LS for Leave and Steinberg, triallaw.com.
Edward A. Steinberg, partners with Daniel Leave, Leave and Steinberg, outstanding personal injury lawyers. Thank you so much
really?
For
and I still
educating
have three
our
more
listeners.
Questions.
See what happens
I
all the time?
I told you.
Okay,
I
well,
know.
Part two
okay,
with
Eddie
Steinberg.
Okay, so you just
Steinberg.
Have to come back because I had other questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you very
Thank
much
you so
for
much
being
for
here,
me.
Edward.
I really do appreciate it.
And for our listeners, thank you for joining us, and come back next week and join Deborah Orell and I in Women's Rights at the Workplace right here at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN's, that's the Progressive Radio Network's channel, station. That's where we are. And we look forward to being with you then. Thanks for joining us. And remember, stay strong, have a strong and powerful week, and whatever else you do, if you have challenges at work, what do we say, Deborah?
Don't quit.
See you later. Ciao.